This is an interview with J. Philip Richley, former mayor of the city of Youngstown for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program concerning the shutdown of Youngstown Sheet and Tube by Philip Bracey at the Gaffero offices on April 10th, 1981 at 3:30 p.m.
My name is Phyllis.
Can I talk?
3:44, and I attended John Carroll University in Cleveland, the University of Michigan, Youngstown State University, and the University of Pittsburgh, and I have a degree as a Bachelor of Engineering from Youngstown State University. I've done graduate work at the University of Pittsburgh, attended the Naval Academy Prep School, and also attended the Quartermaster School in the United States Navy. I have been employed over the years by the East Ohio Gas Company, the City of Youngstown, Mahoning County, the State of Ohio, and the Cafaro Company. I am not retired. I'm still actively working full-time and have a whole variety of so-called honors, awards, and other recognition, including a doctorate of engineering from Youngstown State University and many other types of awards and recognition items statewide and some of them nationally. I served as president of the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, which is a national organization, while I was director of transportation of the state of Ohio. And I also served on President Carter's National Highway Transportation Advisory Committee. Those are just two of a whole variety of organizations that I'm affiliated with. I am a member of St. Anthony Church in Youngstown, Ohio, and belong to a number of miscellaneous social and fraternal organizations, and have a variety of hobbies and special interests, including reading and golfing and relaxing in the sun in Florida and things such as that. Okay.
Who was responsible for first getting involved in public life?
I believe that back in 1948 or 49 or perhaps 1950, I could suggest that Anthony B. Flask, who was a councilman of the Third Ward here in Youngstown, was most influential in getting me involved in public life. I was a surveyor at the time, and he assisted me in obtaining employment with the city of Youngstown in 1950. And that was the initial contact I had with the city about 30 years ago.
Okay. do you remember the circumstances, like where you were and how you found out about the shutdown, or the announcement of the shutdown of Youngstown Sheet and Tube?
Sure I do. It was in the fall of 1977, and I was in a campaign while I was running for mayor of the city of Youngstown as a Democrat, and I had prepared a number of position papers, one of them having to do with economic development, which was my principal interest, and I simply picked up a Sunday paper, as I recall. I believe the date was September 19th. I picked up a Sunday paper and read about it in the newspaper, and like everyone else, was somewhat shocked at the size and magnitude and the depth of it. However, fortunately or unfortunately, I was not shocked by the fact that it occurred. It was almost as though it were inevitable, so that I was not shocked by the fact that it occurred, but I was shocked by the size and the magnitude of it.
At that time, you were...
I was a candidate. I was a candidate for mayor. That was in September of 77, and in fact, most likely about 5 or 6 weeks before the election, which was in the first week of November. The announcement was made, and I immediately reacted to it by preparing a second position paper on economic development, which I made public at that time. This was before the election, taking into account the most recent occurrences and and made some proposals on how I thought we might eventually be able to work out of that particular dilemma. And those were published, and they're a matter of record. And I think at that time was when I started to talk about the need for moving in the area and toward the goal of diversification. And that's the kind of theme that I've been pronouncing ever since.
Was there any contact, I realize with the election going on, it probably was a little difficult, but was there any contact from, let's say, Mayor Hunter's office, asking you to participate in any events that maybe?
There was not from Mayor Hunter's office, no, but there was from Congressman Carney's office. Shortly after the announcement took place, Congressman Carney called me and told me that he wanted to put together what he described at that time as an ad hoc committee of interested citizens and businessmen and political leaders, asked me if I wanted to participate, I told him that I would. And in fact, we did have perhaps two or three or four meetings in the fall of 1977 before the election, and Mayor Hunter was part of that group at that time. So my involvement with this matter unofficially prior to January of 78, was simply as a member of an ad hoc committee upon the invitation of Congressman Carney. We worked with 8 or 10 people in trying to formalize some ideas and concepts on what ought to be done or what could be done.
Was that meeting the same week as the announcement, or?
No, I would say that meeting probably took place within about 2 or 3 weeks after the announcement, and several other meetings took place right on through the end of the year, and even into the next year after I became mayor, that group was still a little active, somewhat active, and then it finally folded up.
Okay. Was that group, I believe it was the Youngstown Area Task Force, did that become MEDVAC in essence?
Well, let's say that group gradually faded away and simply dissipated because, for example, Mayor Hunter was no longer involved, and Congressman Carney was more preoccupied with things in Washington, we were instrumental before I took office. They were instrumental in obtaining, as I recall, a $100,000 federal grant that authorized that so-called ad hoc committee to prepare a report that would lead toward diversification, and that was done before I was in office. After I was in office, we began to put together a more formal structure, what we thought ought to be the beginning of a long-range, far-reaching, more permanent organization outside of government, not in government, but outside of government, that would be charged with the responsibility for overseeing economic development. And so the ad hoc committee kind of faded away. The report that was prepared by Battelle became the foundation for some of the work that was later then taken over by the Mahoning Valley Economic Development Corporation, which is the more permanent group on a two-county basis.
Upon becoming mayor, coming into office, were there any specific items that you focused on as far as the shutdown?
Well, it was our objective, I think, at the beginning, was to try to develop some programs with the assistance of EDA especially, and perhaps HUD. Was twofold. What I first wanted to do is to get the attention of the federal government. By that I mean to get the attention of EDA and HUD, and even the office of President Carter, to make them aware of the depth and scope and magnitude and the gravity of the problem. We were surprised at the depth and the scope and magnitude of the problem. In other words, we were shocked to find out how many people were ultimately going to be laid off. As I recall, 4,500 people within a 90-day period, less than 90 days, and also that in the future, we expected that the Briar Hill plant would be shut down with another 1,500 to 1,800. So we tried quickly, first to get in touch with EDA, HUD and also the White House. We also got in touch immediately with the JNL people. At that time, they were Likes Steel, however, to try to find out what their thoughts were on the new, on the shutting down of the Briar Hill plant, which hadn't happened yet, which they predicted would be happening in about 18 months. That is the fall of 1979. Our primary purpose in getting HUD and EDA involved was to really find out what we could do to assist the laid off people. We thought that that was the primary pressing priority, is try to find ways to help the people that are going to be laid off to find new jobs, to help them with unemployment compensation, to help them with trade readjustment benefits. We also tried to get the federal people in to help us develop some programs that would provide some what we called mortgage assistance payments for people that couldn't pay their mortgages. We talked with organizations, the social organizations locally, mental health, and others who we thought might eventually have a higher number of applicants from laid-off steel workers. We communicated with the president's office, some of the members of his staff, to try to persuade him to understand the depth of the problem and to work with us. We recommended to the federal government, and we did this in Chicago, that they send into the area what I called an economic disaster team, where we would have a representative of EDA, a representative of HUD, a representative of the president's office, a representative of DOT and the Department of Commerce, to sit in Youngstown for maybe 90 days and try to help us on the local level formulate some plans right in Youngstown. And at the end of those 90 days, they would go on home, but their recommendations then would be keyed into federal programs in order to try to rush and expedite any help that might come. And we also simultaneously tried to put in motion a movement for economic diversification through the Mahoning Valley Economic Development Corporation. Those are some of the things we tried to do immediately.
Do you remember the exact date or the approximate date of the Chicago meeting?
That meeting probably was in January or February of 1978. It probably was within the first three or four weeks after I took office. At the same time, by that time, I should say, the Ecumenical Coalition had been formed. They got rolling in the fall of 77 before we took office, I would guess. Week or two after the announcement was made, they began to organize and they began to find ways by which they could reopen the closed portion of the sheet and tube. They actually were able to obtain a HUD grant, a $335,000 HUD grant, that was supposed to design a study or a report to show that the sheet and tube could be opened as a community-owned facility. We were a little bit concerned about that because we never quite understood what they were talking about. And we therefore, by the end of the year, before I actually took office, entered into an agreement with Bishop Malone and Senator or Congressman Carney, myself and as mayor, and I believe it was Mr. Lessiganich representing organized labor, and the substance of the agreement was such that upon completion of the report by the Ecumenical Coalition, it would be turned over to the Mahoning Valley Economic Development Corporation for implementation. So we had an understanding that if the coalition wanted to go ahead and put together a report that would try to find a way to reopen the plant, the Ecumenical Coalition was going to be taking on the responsibility of preparing the report with the HUD grant, and the Development Corporation, which we were planning to form, was going to take on the responsibility of implementing whatever came out of that report that HUD was going to pay for. The memorandum of understanding that was signed between the bishop, myself, Lessiganich, and Carney was to kind of put all that on paper so that there wouldn't be any misunderstanding about what the coalition was going to do
and what the Development Corporation was going to do. And all of that came about primarily and as a result of some meetings that were held in Washington, one or two of which I attended, where the federal people, Bob Hall especially, after listening to a report on the Beetle, a presentation on the Beetle report, comments by the coalition and comments by Congressman Carney and comments by myself, suggested that we go back home and try to get our own thoughts together and agree on what it was we wanted to do and then report back to them. All right, the getting the thoughts together was the memorandum of understanding that I'm talking about, which we did in fact execute. And once that was signed, then the grant was approved and the coalition did get the money and they did begin the report right around the first of the year, right around the first of January 1978. So they began the report. They hired some consultants from New York, from Washington. They hired some people from the New England states, Boston, as I recall. And they were studying the possibility of reopening the Sheet and Tube as a community-owned facility. We were in the process of developing programs for economic rediversification, and that's about where we were in January.
Was there any attempt prior to this memorandum of agreement to get the Ecumenical Coalition involved in your efforts, or was there a feeling of that you didn't really know how to plug them in? Or?
No, they were involved. Father Stanton, who is one of the leaders in the coalition, was also a member of the board of the New Development Corporation, which we created. He was a board member, so we involved them through Father Stanton, and he attended virtually all of the meetings, and he's still a member of the board today.
at that time, you were a positive force in the formation of the broadening of the base, I suppose, of the original group into...
Yes, we increased it from about 6 to 8 to 10 people up to something like 24 or 26 people. We involved all of the cities in the two counties. We involved all of the... we structured it as a two-county organization because I felt from the beginning that economic development of this valley could not be carried out by one city or one county. It was one economic entity, and if we were going to succeed or fail in improving the economy and increasing jobs and employment, we really were one economic entity, and you couldn't separate one town from another. So that it was always my feeling that we ought to all work together and try to do what we could on an organized basis. And therefore, we had representation from two counties. We had representation from organized labor, representation from the business sector, and representation from the citizenry. We had about 26 members, I think, on the board as it was originally conceived, and then later, at the request of the federal government, it was increased to about 30 or 31. So, yeah, we broadened it and made it a two-county organization. Principal purpose of the organization was to retain existing industry, find ways to cause existing industry to expand, and to recruit new industry. That's the principal thrust of the group.
What was the organizational structure of MedVet?
We had a president or a chairman. We had an executive committee of approximately 8 people. We had a number of other subcommittees, finance committee. We had special committees for special purposes, bylaws committee, and we had a full board. And then we later had an executive director, and he had a small staff of people, and we had a separate office in which they were housed.
How did you see the role of MedVac in the economic development?
I thought that organization could act as a clearinghouse and a force in unifying the community, unifying the governmental officials, unifying labor and management, a clearinghouse for HUD grants, a clearinghouse for EDA grants, and that's what it really became, because EDA did recognize it as the organization that would speak for the valley, and they did provide to us, as I recall, $600,000 or $700,000 with which to operate, and they recognized us in writing as the group that would be responsible for economic development insofar as the federal government was concerned. It was an attempt to unify and to coordinate and it was not by any means designed to supplant what the cities wanted to do on their own or what the county commissioners wanted to do on their own, but it was meant to provide services to some of the cities that didn't have people on their staff. It was meant to do a little bit of national advertising and recruiting that the cities couldn't do. It was meant to ensure that there was a greater degree of cooperation between the two counties, which wasn't very good at that time and never was really very good. And it was meant to bring labor and business together if that was possible to do. So not, the cities individually couldn't do these things, and a great many of them didn't have any inclination to do them. And most of the cities and even county officials tended to be very parochial and very limited in their interest in this particular area. And we felt that there needed to be some sort of organization that tried to bring them all together. That was my idea. It still is. And it is still operating and recognized by the feds as the agency which is granted the funds by which to carry it out.
Besides yourself, who I understand you served on most of the committees, as subcommittees, as well as being president of MNPA, who are the activists in the organization?
We had many of the bankers from the Youngstown area. Art Young, for example, was always a very active leader. Jim Griffin, who has since passed away, was a strong representative of labor. Frank Lesiganich was a labor representative. George Bindis, county commissioner, Mahoning County commissioner. We had a couple of commissioners from Trumbull County. We had a number of businessmen. Bill Brown, the editor of the Youngstown Vindicator. A number of other people that I can't remember at this time. There were at least 15, Father Stanton was very active, at least 15 people, including gentleman named Paul Wigton, who was president of Republic Steel, who was still a viable steel plant in the area based up in Warren, and primarily labor leaders, public officials, bankers, and a few citizens.
Do you think the role of MEDVAC changed as it grew?
Not really, no. I think its purpose today is pretty much what it has always been, and that's to first, try to unify the area economically. Secondly, to try to break down the geographical boundaries and barriers and bring together business and labor on a two-county basis. And thirdly, to develop programs for the area rather than just one individual city or county. It didn't matter to us where a plant expanded or if a new plant came in, where it went in. Our principal objective was that if we could get 10 jobs in Mahoning in the Mahoning Valley, maybe Mahoning County might get 6 and, you know, Trumbull County might get 4, and it really didn't matter where the plant got located. The jobs would be distributed on the basis of people who would apply, and they would pretty much follow the population division of the two counties. So we weren't pressing locations in any particular political subdivision at all. What we were pressing for is to enhance the entire valley as a whole. And we thought that everybody would benefit from that.
Could you tell me the background of the National Steel Research Center?
Yes, that project was one which I believe was the original idea was proposed to me by Senator Glenn and then reinforced by Tom Cleary, who was one of the officials at the Youngstown Sheet and Tube before it was shut down. Both of them told me that they thought from their perspective that research and development in the steel industry ought to be promoted, and one of the possible uses for an old shut down steel plant might be the development of a national steel research facility. So we felt pretty comfortable with that idea as one of our projects at that time, and we were able to get some people involved from the business sector as well as labor. We were able to get a number of people from the University Urban Affairs Department involved, and we did put together a report on some concepts and ideas we had that would turn some of the idle facilities into productive facilities for the development of new technology and steel that could be used nationally. And that report did go in, and it was reviewed by, I believe it was Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, that the Department of Housing and Urban Development asked to look at it. And while they didn't reject it, they simply felt that that was not a function that government ought to be involved in. So if government didn't want to be involved in it, then obviously there was not a heck of a lot that you could do about it. Although government was involved in Conrail, they were involved in the Tennessee Valley Authority, they were involved in the development of subsidization of aviation facilities, they were involved in the interstate highway system, they were involved in many, many, many areas around the country that had to do with particular segments of industry. And the only reason they didn't want to get involved in steel was because it was a hot political issue, and they quite frankly didn't know enough about how to get involved and didn't want to take any chances and wanted to play it safe. We were not successful in trying to get too much interest from them, although many people still thought it was a good thing.
What were your personal feelings about the proposed worker buyout of Sheet 2? Do you favor that kind of effort?
Not really. I never really felt very comfortable with it. First of all, I never really fully understood it. I never understood what it was they were exactly trying to do, and I'm not sure very many other people understood it either. There was some question of the motivations of the consultants who were involved, their leanings. There was a question of whether they really understood what they meant by worker buyout, whether the employees would own the plant, or whether stock options would be offered. That was never really clarified. I never felt that the idea had much chance of success, but we did work with the coalition to try to do all we could to cause it to happen, primarily because we were all looking for solutions, and anybody that could come up with something that would work would be a welcome solution. So while I never really got too excited about it and never thought that much would come of it, we nevertheless did support it, and we were actively involved in trying to promote it.
On July the 12th, 1978, you and Father Stanton held a joint news conference. Could you tell me a little bit about that? Particular news, was that in response to their, I believe at the time there were press hype, for lack of a better word, stating that you know, there was a division between the Ecumenical Coalition and the people in MedVac. Could you kind of elaborate a little bit on that?
What this was a news release that was issued jointly by Father Stanton and myself, was simply an attempt to clear the air on the relationship between the coalition and the project, which we thought had some viability at a steel research center for the development of steel technology. I think the news release simply said that if the coalition's project were successful, that the Development Center for New Technology would be a part of that, and there's nothing wrong with that. We were trying to do all we could to avoid the illusion that there was any real conflict. You know, whenever you've got people trying to do different things in a community, there are always many people who are trying to shoot you down and trying to divide those people who are trying to get some things done. And that was happening to us, and we just thought it was good, would be good if we were to issue some kind of a joint statement saying that we're all in support of the same thing, and if the coalition's project succeeds, there's no reason why it can't be joined together with the research center. And that was the purpose of this news release.
You were also instrumental in getting the UDAG grant filed. As I recall, you had a major problem with
we prepared the application. I think it was for maybe as high as $16 million or something like that for the coalition, because they didn't have the staff capability to do so. And like all other UDAG grants, there had to be private money by which to stimulate the public money, and the ratio had to be 4 or 5 to 1. The application was completed, it was submitted, it went to the feds, and it was in good order with the exception of the fact that there was never any private money that the coalition was able to get to support the application for public funds. Therefore, while we had a good application and the idea was great, and there just weren't any private entrepreneurs who had an interest in investing private money. Therefore, the application was reviewed and simply tabled, and it was never approved because there wasn't enough substance in it to get it to be approved. We helped to put it together as part of our program of cooperation, but again, we were never optimistic that it could be approved if there weren't some private money to support it. There was a meeting held in the White House, which Jack Watson presided. The coalition was represented. I believe Bishop Malone was there, Reverend Burt, Reverend Rawlings, I recall, may have been there. Father Stanton was there. Jim Griffin on our board was there. Frank Lesaganich, I was there, and a number of others. And the purpose of that meeting was to try to get the attention of the president's office in terms of the need for assistance in the Mahoning Valley, and try to get from them some commitment that if a program could be put together, that they'd be willing to support it and willing to fund it. And we weren't trying to propose any particular program specifically, only to get some commitment that if we could come up with a program, they might support it. Well, they did agree that they would provide $100 million in loan guarantees, and they would keep that option open for us until such time as the coalition report was complete. And when it was complete, it would be included in an application for UDAG funds, and the loan guarantees then could be a part of the overall development package through the UDAG application. And that was the purpose of that meeting. The UDAG application, I believe, was initiated in the early part of 1979 and submitted perhaps in the spring or summer of 79. And it incorporated the $100 million loan guarantee. However, again, there just wasn't any private money available, and there weren't any buyers or takers with respect to the private sector to become involved in that application. Therefore, the application just failed.
When the May 24th, 1979, the coalition announced that it would not continue any further because the government announced they would not support the project, did MedVac pursue the steel research?
No, I think by that time, or about the same time, we were notified by Department of Commerce that while they didn't find any special problem with our proposal, and it got a fair review from Lehigh University, they didn't feel it was the role of government to be involved. And if they're not going to be involved as in government, then we simply had to back off. There was nowhere else we could go. So that proposal didn't go anywhere either, as well as the coalition's proposal. And by the middle of the year, by the middle of 79, both the coalition proposal and the technology proposal both had fell on deaf ears, and there wasn't any place else to go. So we started to move ahead as rapidly as we could on diversification, which is what I always wanted to do in the first place. And by that time, I think everybody was pretty well sick and tired of hearing about the Save Our Valley campaign, and sick and tired of trying to open a dead plant, which was never going to open again. Many of us were always convinced of that. But we had to go through the entire process to be sure that that had happened. A year and a half was used up in that exercise, and it was a very good piece of work that the coalition did, because they led the charge when there was no one there in the fall of 77. However, it was an exercise in futility by the fact that while they provided great spiritual and moral leadership, not a great deal of business sense came out of the whole exercise. So by the middle of 79, we were working hard trying to get in place an organization over the two county area that would function out of a separate office And we did that. I think we started a new office in the spring of 79 and leased some space in Liberty Township on Belmont Avenue and hired some people, and they are in business. I also, when I became mayor, opened up an office in Youngstown, an Office of Economic Development in Youngstown, for the purpose of promoting Youngstown only in terms of Youngstown projects, and hired an economic development director. And he worked very closely on Youngstown projects as related to area-wide projects. And we were successful in, for example, reopening the Republic Rubber plant, which had been closed down, and bringing back about 150 people to work. And we did get them $750,000 in UDAG funds, as well as a couple of million in loan guarantees. We were initially responsible for bringing into the area the Commuter Aircraft Corporation in January of 79, and we submitted the application for Commuter Aircraft for the UDAG grant of $3.5 million, which was ultimately approved, although Youngstown didn't become the beneficiary because of housing problems. And we provided some grants for McNicholas Transfer and some other corporations in the area that needed help. So we were involved in the city in terms of economic development in Youngstown projects alone. And we were also involved on a two-county basis because the valley as a whole would benefit from any project that would show up anywhere.
Do you think that there's any facts or any particular items that you feel are important to the understanding of the events that took place during that period that I have left out that you would like to incorporate?
I think the big thing that you should keep in mind is that the closing of that plant, the sheet and tube plant, and the subsequent closing of the U.S. Steel plants didn't happen as instantaneously as everybody would have loved to believe. The fact is that they were old plants. They were 80 to 90 years old. There were very little new investments made in those plants in the last 10 or 15 years. The corporations, I think, had made quiet private decisions to do this a long time ago. They didn't put any money into air pollution devices. They didn't put any money into water pollution control devices. They stalled on the permits for 5 or 6 years, and it was inevitable in a matter of time before the roof caved in. And when it caved in, it seemed that no one who was in the steel business was surprised. The public was surprised, and the public was taken back because of the magnitude of it. I don't think that the steel industry at any time in the last 10 years had any idea other than the fact that they were going to be shut down. I know when Like Steel bought sheet and tube out, the intention was to shut it down as rapidly as possible. When they bought Briar Hill, the intention was to shut it down. I think the trouble with a lot of us in Youngstown, especially those who were not in government, is they didn't want to accept reality. They didn't ever want to accept the facts of life, and the facts of life that these are old, decrepit plants that cost too much to operate, and you can't keep them running when you're not making money. And that never really rang true or never came home to a great many people. And year after year, and even today, I hear people talking about wanting to reopen those plants, and there isn't a chance in a million that that's ever going to happen. I think if we learn anything from that, looking back, it's simply to point out that, out of that disaster and chaos, you ought to have some new opportunities that ought to show up. And if we would just get our head out of the sand and not bury it into the sand in terms of steel as the basic foundation of this valley, and look around and consider that we are diversified and promote diversification, that in the long haul, the more kinds of work we're involved in manufacturing and service in the valley, the better off we're going to be. We're better off to have 100 plants with 1,000 each working in those plants than to have two or three large plants with 10,000 working in them.
Okay. Is there anything else that you feel? Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. My name is J. Philip Richley. I live at 3036 Chalisma Drive in Youngstown, Ohio, zip code 44509. My telephone number is area code 216-793-6320, and I was born in Italy on April 27th of 1926. I am married. My wife's name is Josephine, and we were married in 1948. I'm a veteran of the United States Navy. I entered the Navy in December of 1943 and was discharged in June of 1946. My father, who is deceased, his name is Nicholas, and my mother's name is Rose, and she is still living. I have two children, Phyllis Kenanchy, who is 30 years of age, and I have a son, John, who is 26 years of age. I graduated from Niles McKinley High School in 1943 and attended John Carroll University in Cleveland, the University of Michigan, Youngstown State University, and the University of Pittsburgh. I think from there on you're in good shape.